Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Top Chef podcast on the Wrap Up Network. That is not our cemented name, but that is what this is for now. I am Haley Strong. Welcome to my podcast and my podcast alone. Today, I and solely me will be talking about Padma Lakshmi's new show on Hulu, Taste the Nation. I had a great time watching it. It was really good. Okay, you guys can head on out now. Bye.
Haley, that was a really good podcast.
Yeah,
that you
thanks.
Did. Honestly, I think
it was worth every penny of the $100,000 that I pay to be a patron of your podcast.
The shorter, the better. I think everyone was like, too much rambling, not enough talk about Top Chef. Like, I think that's what you need. You need.
Do we get those comments?
You need Vine size podcasts. I think nowadays.
Yeah,
the Vine podcast network.
How long was a Vine?
Six seconds, I believe.
6 seconds. 6 second podcast would be impressive if you could pull that off.
I missed the whole Vine thing because when it was popular, I lived at my parents' house in the country that had really bad Wi-Fi, so I could never get anything to load. So I just missed the whole Vine trend.
There's a really iconic Vine about a girl dancing with her cat that I frequently find and re-find on Twitter, like in my own profile. I wonder if you can.
Yeah, I can see if I can find it right now. Vine girl dancing with cat. Yeah. Hold on.
Yep, there she is.
Yes. Okay. So here's what's going to happen. If everyone wants, okay. I'm going to share this screen.
Oh,
into the thing. Okay.
All right, wow. So
here we go.
Why is there so many?
All right, you ready? So this is going to be the lady dancing with the cat, and it's the best Vine in the history of Vines. Let's see how it goes.
We don't see your screen, by the way, Josh, or your YouTube video.
We're literally just watching the Funhouse mirror, by the way.
The endless tunnel of stream.
Yeah. Oh, you can't see it.
No, we can literally just see ourselves. Is that your thing? Is the Vine us?
It's the endless tunnel of StreamYard.
All right,
it's like those bullshit regional theater productions where it's like the real enemy is you, and they turn a mirror onto the audience at the end. You're the real sheep.
How many of those performances did you do in your theater?
Oh my God, I could fill a theater with the amount of performances I've done of that type of stuff. Okay,
here we go. Here we go. We got it. We got this back. Okay.
Why is it 1 minute and 7 seconds long?
Because it's looping. Because it loops so well. So just to describe what we're starting with is this woman. She has a sweater on. She has great pajama pants.
Someone sent this to me on my birthday like 4 years ago.
That's
how I found it.
And all I Googled was lady dancing with cat Vine, and it showed up immediately. We'll put it in the show notes, but you can watch it as well.
It's really important that
But I'm going to play. I'm going to play this now for the gang. Here we go.
I like how half of these don't involve the cat. Yeah.
So she's just dancing really cool. She like lifts up the cat. She does some like cool action with her frying pan. She's in the bathroom like butt grinding against the bathroom.
The crazy thing about this is I bet she made like millions of dollars off of this before Vine went bankrupt, right?
Also, the music is incredible. I think we need to stop down to appreciate the song.
I wonder what the song is, because if it's easily licensable, I would say that should be the theme song for Beyond Top Chef.
Yeah, Emily Bond is turning red.
It does loop well, you're right. Is that a dishwasher or an oven she's standing on?
It's hard to know. It's hard to know.
I think it's...
Anyway, so welcome to Beyond Top Chef.
Beyond Dancing Cat Lady.
Josh Wagler, Emily Fox, Kurt Clark, Mike Bloom, all here too.
We're here.
Yeah.
So well,
it's good to have you talking this week, because you were on the podcast last week and just oddly decided not to speak because
I'm glad your microphone's working.
Well, yeah, I had a lot of I basically just sat in silence. I tried to mime the podcast, but really only the patrons investing a heavy $500K into
the mime could get
the mime edit. But I thought you guys had a lot of great thoughts about the season and where the hell we go from here. Evidently, where we go from here is a 5 minute talk about Vine and then maybe some talks about a Hulu series. Haley, how did you watch this series? Because Hulu, I do not believe, is a thing north of the border.
With
I will not disclose it on air.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But you had your ways.
I asked Ethan if he could find it for me, and he did.
Good job, Ethan.
Nice.
And that is all I'll
which
say.
Is good, because I feel like given what the series is about, I think it would be bad if it's a series that sort of discloses a good amount of the globe from, you know, being able to access this, considering how much it is about the internationality of the country. However, I will say, one of my very few quibbles with the show, Taste the Nation, United Tastes of America was literally right there. And you don't go with it. I don't understand.
That happened. United Tastes.
I feel like that exists.
United Tastes.
I think Taste the Nation also exists.
Of America. United Tastes of America is an atlas of food facts and recipes from every state. Didn't your parents give us this for Christmas or something?
No.
It feels like something they would have given us.
No, that's something.
It's also a cooking channel show.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's a cooking channel show.
And Taste the Nation is also a cooking show.
Oh, right, with Jeffrey Saad. I forgot about that guy. He was one of the front runners at the end of Next Food Network Star.
Yeah.
He had long hair. He had like a bit of a Farquaad going on, and then he shaved it down to shorter cropped hair. Jeffrey Saad had United Tastes of America.
I knew that it existed,
I would also encourage people to Google the Food United States of America. I'm going to put the link in the So this is from the food blog Food Diggity, where they turned each state into a pun slash image. They have California, where it's the state of California, cut out of kale. They've got New Jerky. They've got Pork Lo Mein.
Oh my God. This is my Pokemon.
Yeah.
I love this.
Keene, Washington. It's made out of quinoa. So this is Rocky Rhode Island.
Wisconsin is good.
Yeah. I think I'm trying to remember some of the other ones they have, but this is another great food source is the Food Diggity and the Food United States of America.
No, not everyone can hear that, Emily. Don't worry about it, everybody. I may have accidentally reloaded the lady dancing with the cat in our web browser.
is that the new Rickroll?
Yeah. No.
Oh, God.
No.
Sorry.
Huh. So what did we all think?
I think
so
which parts did each person watch? Because I think we all watched maybe a little slightly different sampling.
Well, I think also just to reset it in case you missed last week's podcast and like you've wandered in here and you thought that the 10 seconds Haley did at the start really was just the podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if you turned it off.
It's possible.
What if the podcast, if they saw like the hour and a half that this is probably going to end up being, they thought it was just like the loop of me saying the same thing over
much like that video
Well, what people missed also is that you were dancing with your cat as you were doing your first 10 second spiel.
Yeah, Haley, you didn't have to take us to the bathroom and to the kitchen, but I'm grateful that you did.
Why not? I thought you guys wanted a house tour.
I do. Well, last week we said we would talk about Taste the Nation with Padma, Padma's Hulu show. And I feel like that's a nice bit of continuity from as we are endeavoring to keep talking about food weekly, maybe about TV shows, maybe not about TV shows, but certainly for right now about a TV show. I think to use someone who is not just a friendly face from Top Chef, but is like the friendly face from Top Chef, right? Like she's the host of Top Chef and she has her new show and it is, you know, a few weeks old at this point. I think it came out mid-June.
Yeah, I want to say it came out maybe either right after or right before the finale of season 17 aired. So very fortuitous timing. I can imagine.
I wonder if they planned that.
I would imagine.
Jokes, they obviously planned that.
Well, I don't know, actually. I mean, Hulu is not necessarily that tied into Bravo.
They're not. I mean, Hulu is Disney owned at this point. I'm not sure the exact breakdown, but NBC is launching its new streaming service fairly soon.
Peacock.
Wait.
Uh-oh.
Is there a hyphen in there? Is it really Peacock?
No, they're not. They're not Klingon, Kurt.
It's Peacock. Peacock is premiering, I believe, July 15th. I'm pretty sure.
P'K. Okay.
I got to watch one of the new shows from it, Brave New World, an adaptation of the book.
Oh, yeah.
It's surprisingly pretty good.
So it's not. So this is not going to be a Quibi, is what you're saying.
Well, the thing is, I don't know that a lot of people are going to sign on for Peacock. So I think Brave New World is like a really good new sci-fi show that's probably going to go underwatched, which is a shame. It should probably just be on the USA Network. The point being, NBC used to have a Hulu presence, but since Disney not only owned ABC, but they also bought Fox. And so Hulu was an ABC, Fox, NBC joint. NBC cut bait and decided, let's build our own thing. So I don't think that there is any sort of coordination between Taste the Nation and Top Chef in terms of when Taste the Nation comes out. I think it is.
Padma is an EP. So do EPs have any say? And
I don't think in terms, I don't think in terms of programming like that.
No. Right. I think that comes down to the network, unless she has a really good relationship with the network. And when they say like, what would you prefer it airs? And if that's the case, then all the power to her, and her ability to do this is again fortuitous, because it allows people like us to be able to talk about something Top Chef related and to see some really fantastic culinary stuff with the fabulous Padma Lakshmi holding it down, even though Top Chef is now, a few weeks old at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I can completely see them being like, we want to maximize viewership for this. And I think the most momentum we're going to get is like coming off the trajectory of the finale of Top Chef. So there could be business reasons from a viewability perspective in terms of audience numbers for them to actually leverage the finale to launch into this. So, but who knows?
So in the Hulu model, actually, I feel like it's variable with the Hulu model, where the Netflix model is almost always new show, drop them all at once. Hulu sometimes, it might go the Handmaid's Tale route and air them weekly. This one chose to drop all 10 episodes at once, which I think allowed for at least some of us to view a bit more of like a mixed bag, like a customized playlist of episodes. I personally have seen the first 7 episodes. I just started watching from the beginning. My hot take, which maybe I'll talk about in a little bit, is that I feel like they may have mixed up the episodes a little too much, and that there should have been one episode in particular that they started with. But at least this allows the opportunity to check out those episodes if you're not into like the first couple.
Yeah. So Fox, Kurt and I had a play date the other night, a virtual Zoom play date where we watched Taste the Nation together. Haley, you were invited.
I know I had to work, and
I want to get ahead of like you.
Yeah,
like,
no. I totally know.
To be fair, Josh, you're the one that usually snarks her first.
It depends. If I snark Haley first, it's a loving snark.
It's a loving snark,
and it's like an anticipation of getting snarked first. So you gotta be protecting your.
I was at work. Ontario has opened things up. We're in phase 2, restaurant, patio, et cetera, et cetera. It has been so unbelievably hot here the last week, and please do not take that as a complaint. I hate winter. I will take the 40 degree heat. For those of you who do not know the metric system, 40 degrees is about 100 or so.
Oh, wow.
Plus is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So with the Humidex and everything, it's felt about 40 degrees. And then so people are coming to eat later. So I just never know when I'm going to be home. So I just didn't RSVP to that invite. I just, if I'm being honest with everyone, I ghosted you guys this week a little bit.
It's all good. Yeah. It's all good. You know how I feel about ghosts. I love them. If you didn't,
do you?
No, I'm a fan. I like ghosts. I think
I'm afraid of them.
Specifically busting them for the second time.
I'm not afraid of no ghosts. But Kurt, Fox and I, we watched Burritos at the Border, the first episode. Then we skipped ahead to What is Chop Suey Anyway, which has, Ali Wong in it, and it's exploring Chinese food. And then we closed out with Don't Mind If I Dosa, which was, I think, the most personal episode that I saw, at least, as far as Padma, like diving into her own story of being an immigrant in America. Emily had a very strong edict of, we are not watching the All American Wiener. You voted decisively legs instead of hot dogs in that matter.
I know, which I'm realizing now might be a mistake for you.
It's okay.
No, I feel like a lot of us know that story, or at least are familiar enough with, I don't know, for me at least, I'm not compelled by hot dogs.
Yeah.
Well, and gotta watch this. Like,
but Fox, you watched basically everything otherwise independently. You didn't watch that episode.
And I haven't seen the poke one yet.
And you haven't seen the poke one yet.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't mind missing the us not watching the hot dog one, because I think one of the things I like about these shows is it kind of starts to put things on my radar in terms of, oh, I want that. Oh, I want that. Oh, I want that.
I didn't need to be
tempted by the hot dog. That's a low effort for that button to be pushed. Whereas, not that the other ones are like more difficult, but at least it's I feel better about being tempted about something that is like expanded.
You're a Chicago guy. Like, you know, the hot dogs are in your blood.
Do you have celery salt in your apartment?
I do not. I just have kosher salt. I also don't have any hot dogs in my apartment.
Well, we got to fix two things, it sounds like. But there were some great moments while the three of us were watching, where like the first episode ended, the burritos at the border, and like in like full sync, the three of us were like, I want Mexican food. Like very badly, like we wanted Mexican food. Then we watched the Dosa episode and all three of us were like, I want doses now. Yeah. This is a show that succeeds very well in making you hungry and making you want to try foods that are either outside of your comfort zone or are in your comfort zone, but maybe you hadn't considered like the full context of where the foods come from and like the authenticity behind the food. I love this. Fox and I used to like our favorite show on TV was Parts Unknown. And we took the death of Anthony Bourdain very, very hard. We even before he passed away, we would talk about him as dad. He was like our TV dad. And we love that genre. And I think like in our like loftiest of dreams for ourselves was like always like someday, like, let's get successful enough to do a travel show like this. This would be fun. We love to travel. Totally. We love to eat. Like that is a huge piece of our love language is traveling and eating. And Bourdain really captured that for us. And a lot of shows have like come along to like try and fit into that. But like he pioneered something. And not that like he was like the first person to ever do a travel show or a food show by any stretch, but there was just something so singular about the way he did it in which it became art beyond just being food and travel. I think a lot of different people have tried to certain degrees of success. Everybody loves Phil or what is it? It's Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix, who we refer to as our like food and travel TV stepdad. Like yeah. Phil's good. Phil's a nice guy. Phil's really trying. Phil's really nice. He's not dad. We'll often turn to each other and say things like that.
And we're always like, oh, mom really picks them.
Yeah. But Padma might be mom. Yeah. I think that Padma, who is already so familiar to us through Top Chef and getting to hang out with her in this context, she is such a good interviewer, I think. She has the thing that I always at my best aspire to when I'm interviewing someone, which is to just like try and like shut up and exude enough like I'm here for you energy to like let you talk and you tell me what's up. And she does that so well in these episodes. There are often long stretches of time where Padma's just not saying anything and the people she's interviewing are articulating the stories and Padma's just absorbing them. And then when she does speak, she speaks with just a carefully curated amount of words that demonstrate how closely she's listening to the story and helping it to further along. She knows food so well. She's so fun. She's excellent in this role. I loved this show. And I guess my two-pronged critique would be, I wouldn't have minded if this was weekly. I would love to have like weekly Padma. I think that maybe that over the binge would have been good for me. And the other is like, I wish it was a little longer. I wish that they'd given her a little more space to do this. And I hope that they do in the future. I know, Kurt, we had a little bit of a disagreement on that like the 30 minute episode is like perfectly bite sized for you. But I
want the full meal.
Well, I would love to see like the 45 to 50 ish minute Taste the Nation with Padma, because I think that she would crush it. And she's crushed what this is so far.
Well, I did expect it to be an hour long episode. So when I loaded up the first one and I saw that it was only 30 minutes, I was like, oh, okay.
Ethan, did you not download the right thing?
Ethan right now is putting the cat's mattress back in his room. The double mattress that our cat sleeps on.
He's dancing with the cat.
I think that what you're speaking towards, Josh, is, you know, I think that something that makes Padma so innately comfortable in this setting is the basis in which she comes in as a woman of color. Because unlike something like, you know, Parts Unknown or even No Reservations, which I think was like Bourdain's sort of like more Americanized take on it, this is all about specifically the immigrant experience. It's less so about like you know, Alton Brown. Let's see where the hot dog comes from. And maybe that's why I also was not a big fan.
Shot not ever watching that, whatever that is you just described.
Wait, you never watched Good Eats before?
No, I watched Good Eats a little
just
bit.
Knowing where a hot dog comes from.
I'm not an Alton Brown guy. I think he's a douche.
Do you want to know how the sausage is made?
Yeah, I think he's a douche. Oh.
But I think that, you know, she, I mean, it comes in every pre-tape package, right? They're like, I'm an immigrant myself. So she, I think even though her story is much different than an Iranian immigrant in Los Angeles, or, you know, in someone who crosses the border every day to get food for their restaurant in Arizona, there is sort of like a common thread that binds them in a form of otherness. And that's what I think the show does really well too, that, you know, I think one of the bigger questions that people had coming into this is like, why do we need this right now? Because there are a load of cooking shows, as Josh said, there have been a load of travel shows. Hell, it might even draw comparisons at the surface level to something like Triple D, which is like, hey, we go to a restaurant and we watch somebody make a meal.
There's no other Guy Fieri, but this is a much more elevated show.
Right. This is like equal parts like cooking show and like history lesson. I loved, maybe it's because of my ignorant ass, but I learned so much about the roots of a lot of cuisines, because I think that at the forefront is this question of like, what is American food? And it essentially is asking, you know, what is America? And, you know, we always use the analogy of a melting pot. Haley, I know Canada is a mosaic, but I guess America is a melting pot. But pot can be used in a different way, in that this is sort of like a stew.
Especially the
California days. Episodes. But there's this idea of like mixing together a lot of different things. And we sort of talk about the gentrification of it a bit over the years. But it's so nice to see people like embrace their ancestral food in a manner of speaking and showing off like how it became an innate part of American culture today. That to me separates the show, and specifically Padma as a host speaking to that experience separates it to me from another random white guy going to a bunch of different restaurants around the country.
100%.
And I can't remember which of the three episodes we watched where it had this sentiment in it, but it, you know, they reflected on the concept of like, you know, go back to where you came from. And it's like, well, if you take all that food away too, like, what does that leave? They viewed that statement through the lens of, well, what does that imply for
burritos on the border? Right.
I thought it might've been
because that was where Padma like very casually drops on us that Americans eat more salsa than ketchup,
condiment,
which produced a great comment. Yeah. From Kurt,
salsa is a trash condiment or ketchup?
Kurt
ketchup.
Shouted out, ketchup's a trash condiment. Which I don't agree. I don't
unless
agree.
It's in chip form, Haley.
quick question. Do you dip grilled cheese in ketchup?
No.
No, tomato soup.
Yeah,
tomato soup.
But I also want to add that I don't think you're a monster for doing so.
The only the only place ketchup belongs in my life is to dip fries in.
Trash. Like,
yeah. It is trash.
On the ground. On the
I told you, man. Fries,
it's not occasionally, a phone.
Occasionally burgers.
Yeah, I think for me, ketchup is a condiment where, like, if you use too much, I don't want something to just taste like ketchup. It's one of those, like, maybe it's because it's so like sugary as well, that like it can definitely overpower stuff.
I'm gonna take a stance with you, Haley, because I know you feel this way. Ketchup on hot dogs, two thumbs up. And everybody who gets mad at us about this, like, go away.
I don't particularly care for mustard or relish, so that really does just leave me with ketchup.
The hot dog is a salty meat. You get the little bit of the sweet with the ketchup, and it's a salty sweet snack.
Here's the real thing. If we're talking about ketchup brands, there's really only one.
Yeah, you gotta,
if you're not picking Heinz, I don't
you're trying.
Know how to talk
yeah,
to
you gotta. It's, I don't but it's the conglomerate.
Yeah, but specifically Heinz purple ketchup.
Wow,
from 1997.
What a throwback.
Or the Shrek version that they brought out in the mid-2000s.
The Crayo and the Cranch.
I think people would look differently at ketchup if they saw like how it gets delivered to restaurants, which is like in a very large bag, which at my particular restaurant is hung on the wall for you to fill the ketchup.
Like a big IV?
It makes me want to puke every time.
Mike goes IV. I go utter. It's an utter of ketchup.
Oh.
So what I will say is, I guess, I don't know, I don't have much experience with like these types of shows that drop all in one day where you can sort of like pick and choose what to watch. I am a little astounded that they saved in my opinion, Don't Mind If I Dosa. I'm glad you guys watched it and during your like custom viewing, because I think it should have either been the first or the last episode.
I think it should have been the last, honestly. I have watched the first five so far, and that one was definitely my favorite episode by far. I think it would have worked well as a finale.
That one you were crying during, Haley?
I cried during all of them.
Even the German one?
Yes. I cry during everything, and that's just who I am as a person. But seeing, like, I think it would have worked really well seeing Padma learn and connect with all these other people about other cultures, and then finishing on her connecting with her culture and you know, sharing about her experience as an immigrant. I thought her talking to her mother was super emotional and poignant. And I have heard that story before. I did read her book last winter. And so I do know a lot about Padma's story coming here and, you know, why her mom had to come here first, et cetera, and her journey with food throughout that. It just felt like a nice button on the end of something. So it was weird that it kind of got buried at three.
Yeah,
it was. I don't know. I really don't know if they honestly just press shuffle and organize this, because I would argue, like, also, I know you guys didn't watch the Gullah episode, but I love that one too.
That one's
Fox
so
and
good.
I watched that. You had already seen it, and then you were like, "You have to watch this." So I
think it's one of the most important episodes that she does, especially
now, and also considering, like, so Gullah is not something that like Padma is unfamiliar with. Top Chef Charleston really made some whiffs in the beginning, first with the challenge on the plantation, but then the challenge immediately after that was they divided up and went to two chefs' households, and one of the chef was a Gullah chef. And so I am a little sad, I think, in retrospect, that the Gullah cuisine was sort of relegated to half of one challenge, because to your point, Emily, there's just so much in there. I love the people that she talked with.
I'm reading Michael Twitty's book right now, which is called The Cooking Gene, where he traces his lineage. Basically, he goes, you know, back in time and tries to figure out where all of his ancestors are from, and then tries to sort of connect the dots in terms of the dishes that they brought over and the types of food and the types of techniques. So like him, you know, cooking in a pot on a fire, like in the middle of the woods, is something that he'll show up and do these kinds of cooking demonstrations for people just to educate them. Highly, highly recommend the book. It won a James Beard Award. He's super, super, he just knows so much about this, and he's so thoughtful in how he puts it together in the book itself. So I highly recommend that book to read. But also, BJ, who later on cooks the crab with her, he's an incredible chef. I highly recommend you follow him on Instagram, at least. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been growing okra and like doing all of these cool plantings, you know, the last couple of months. And I've just been kind of like swiping through and being like, oh, this is so cool. So I think, you know, if we're tracing the roots of a lot of Southern cooking, we've talked about this with Top Chef, but obviously it transcends all of that. It's just a matter of understanding, you know, the food and how it's migrated, and it is very attached to the enslaved people that were brought over. So I just think that's such an important thing that should have been higher on the list.
and I also love the message
Make that episode free for a time too.
That's good.
To Hulu's credit, the episode was available on YouTube for a period of time.
They yanked it. Why?
You know, eventually you have to, you know, do your business, I guess.
But I love this idea though of not even that, like the Geechee, I think, isn't it, or Geechee culture? Geechee, this idea of, you know, this whole initiative that they brought about how Geechee was sort of like something to hide. It was used as a slur for a certain portion of time, and then even again outside of the food base of it, to just have those two people doing that talking head being like, yeah, we're basically bringing it back as a source of pride. Is like, it's a really cool thing. And again, when the show is able to reach beyond, you know, what's on the plate and talk about those things, those are probably my favorite moments, because then it's not just like another cooking show. Then there's really something else to it. So I'm glad that they made it free for a portion of time. And I do believe, listen, IMDb ratings are not all that it's cracked up to be, but I do believe it is the highest rated episode on IMDb of the show.
I did want to call to the IMDb ratings. It feels like not a lot of people have rated this show on IMDb.
They have like you know,
six people have rated like Zen and the Art of Poke. And so like these ratings are not great.
Yeah, they're not.
I think that we need to create a movement here within Beyond Top Chef, that if you are listening to this podcast, go to the IMDb page for Taste the Nation with Padma Lakshmi. Just bomb these reviews with 10 star reviews, please.
Do you think though that's a consequence of the binge model where people just
I do.
Like, I'll admit I'm not a binger myself, but even putting on three of these episodes in a row, even though they're half hour episodes, was still a little bit for me. So I can imagine people like not being able to plow through all 10.
This is why
you've got 166 reviews for the series, but like single digits for each individual episode. And that's very likely a result of the binge model.
This is why
I know that friend of the show and friend of real life, Kurt Bryce, he told me that he's watching one episode per week because he loves Top Chef and he just wants to be able to savor this show as well.
To be fair, Bryce has a huge backlog of other things to watch as well. So I commend him for the restraint. He needs it.
I think that's why that was part of what we loved so much about Parts Unknown.
He just like touched my arm in such a lovely way where he's like, that's part of what we like.
It makes me feel nostalgic, Foxy.
Yeah.
Is that like every week was an event. Like every week you were learning something new. You were going somewhere new. While that show was on, like you were promised every week, despite all of the bullshit that might be happening in your life, you would go to Vietnam or you would go to Puerto Rico or wherever you would go. And I think that would be a big piece of like why, like it would sit with you for days afterwards. Like you would think about everything that had been articulated in that episode in a way that I think like, even with like scripted stuff, you know, just to move it to the conversation of the weekly versus the binge. I just think that the binge, like everything blurs, everything goes swirled together so fast. When the content is as important and vital to our growth as what Padma's covering here in Taste the Nation and what she's covering so well, I really do think that this is a show, despite its availability in the binge model, I do think deserves to be treated in silos to a certain degree, whether or not it's weekly or one per day or something like that. You know, I'm glad that I've only watched as much as I have because I would like to take my time with this.
I will say that because even though I have watched five episodes in the last 3 days, and I feel like each episode does stick out for certain reasons because they cover such a different topic, because we're being told such different stories. I'm not finding that these episodes are blending together really for me.
The only thing for me was I was in. So, you know, the first thing that the three of us watched together online was the burrito episode. And I enjoyed kind of through that experience, like kind of reflecting on, you know, what this was causing me to crave and want to explore. And like we were even talking how like I was exploring like food, like dinner delivery options for Mexican food while we were watching together.
You were commenting on how you've been, you know, you've been in Southern California now for, you know, a few months. Almost a year.
And you
were like, I haven't had a burrito yet.
What?
I've had like there's a Chipotle really close, but obviously I'm not counting that. And I'm like looking at and I'll drive through the neighborhood and I'll see all sorts of like hole in the wall like mom and pop places that I've just not stopped because I was on my way to something else. But I was enjoying that reflection of like what I want to do, and then we jump immediately into the Chop Suey episode, and I'm like, well, I do have no, it's not the same. I have Szechuan food in my fridge, and I'm going to have that to like heat up. And I kind of quickly left behind that burrito like exploration mentally. So I think for me, it's a little bit like jumping from cuisine to cuisine to cuisine in the course of a single meal. You don't really get to reflect as much as you would want to on a single one. So I think I would have preferred to have like do the Bryce model, Haley, where I am watching one episode a week and maybe even like reflecting on and exploring what I learned in that before I get to the next one the next week.
What do we think of the structures of the episode? Because I think that sort of goes back to Josh's point about the timing of it all. We're essentially, I think it's broken up into like four or five segments, and each segment is essentially her with a different guest. And sometimes the guest might be just like, you know, an Ali Wong, a fun personality. There's the Persian episode where I believe she just talks to like a very well-known Persian comedian. Sometimes it's her going into a restaurant and talking with the proprietor and learning how to make something. Sometimes she is out in the wilderness doing something, cooking something.
She's
as well.
Often cooking outdoors, right? I mean, like, yeah. This is a show that should be able to survive whatever the post-pandemic world looks like. She's cooking outside. Like, that's baked into the premise.
Right. But it's interesting because you would think ordinarily it would be like, let's stick with one person the entire time. But it does seem, and maybe that speaks to also like not letting one person speak on behalf of an entire community. I think the show is very purposeful in saying like, we're going to make, you know, look at different people. I love the Chop Suey episode because like you have Cecilia Chang sitting next to the granddaughter of like another luminary in the Chinese food community. And even just that sort of representation is emblematic of how she's able to, even in 30 minutes, take a stride so many different people and so many different experiences that, you know, hopefully represent on the whole a level of what this community is speaking about.
Yeah, I pulled from the three episodes I watched, I had like three very different takeaways. Well, not just the takeaways, but I think also kind of
you
like
ordered takeaway from three different
yeah, three different things, yes. Three different takeaways from three different restaurants. No, like for me, the Dosa episode was a lot more about the things that stuck with me most was it was kind of about Padma's relationship to the food and just kind of Indian food more broad. I didn't tie it as much to the restaurant industry, let's say. Whereas the burrito episode to me was more like, you know, the burrito you're probably accustomed to is not the burrito like that is like, you know, traditional. And there's like a lot of the stuff from the El Paso, you know, Juarez border. And like, what does it look like there? And like,
it's also like pantomiming Mike Bloom style, like the gigantic brick of a burrito. Right. Yeah. That like we're used to.
Exactly.
And like, compare that to like what they were making as like the authentic thing. It's like, yeah, this is a totally different vessel than I think like the standard American, like white American is used to.
Yeah. Like it didn't contain rice. And, yeah. And I'm used to the burritos where it's packed so full of stuff that they have to take a small taco tortilla to patch over the hull breach on the side of the burrito because it just got too full. And then for me, then the Chop Suey episode is interesting because it was a mix of, I think to me, it was much more focused on like the restaurant industry as it pertains to kind of Cantonese culture, but then also like, you know, how chop suey as a kind of an Americanized dish sprung up. And then, but there's all these classic dishes that lots of American born Chinese, the ABCs are used to. But then it also was looking at like, how do we innovate for the future? Like, what is the future of this cooking look like?
Right.
Whereas there wasn't really, I didn't get that from the Mexican or the Indian episodes in terms of, innovating for the future in terms of this cuisine. It was a lot more like, you know, what did it kind of come up from? So I just have three very different takes from the three episodes I watched, which I really liked and appreciate.
Yeah. And I totally get where you're coming from with that, but I really liked how each of the stories was so different and led us in different directions.
Yeah.
Man, I just really loved the show. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm a big, like Josh and Emily, I'm a big travel nerd, big food nerd. I love the way those intertwine together. And I love the history and I love learning about the cultures that are bringing it here and just learning new things about it. But it's presented in a way that's so intertwined with the storytelling and it's so emotional, but not trying to be sad. It's just like really gripping. Really gripping television.
It's like we need a reality competition show because that's how I end up viewing everything. Where you're traveling with Padma and you're stopping in different countries and trying things. At the end of every episode, there's a quiz, and the person that gets the most questions wrong on the quiz gets eliminated. I'm not saying we call it the mole. That would be a step
no too spoilers.
Far.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. No spoilers. No. No. The food's fresh. No spoilage.
They ask you questions like, would you have to learn things while you're eating? Because I have a bad time with multitasking and I know I'd be eliminated first because like I can't concentrate on other things while I'm ingesting very good food.
I just want this to be, I don't know what the competition mechanism is here as much. The reason I went for eating instead of cooking is I want this to be something I could like participate in as a contestant. So like, we're not going to ask you to cook this curry. You just have to eat it and know things. I'm like, okay. And like Tyrion.
That's the Tyrion Lannister quote, right?
Yeah, exactly. I actually have an apron
That's I think it says I cook and I know things.
I eat and I know things.
We need to. I just want to follow along in her footsteps. I don't even have to be at the same table as her. I just have to know that that's the restaurant she just left. So I'm going to go in there and eat. Now, where's she at? I'll wait till she leaves. So, you know,
I think one of the things that I love about this show speaks to something you touched on, Kurt, which is like maybe not necessarily demonstrating how the cuisine is being innovated right now. And I think like part of the point is like, who gives a shit? It doesn't need to be innovated. Yeah. We need to be exposed to it. We need to know where it comes from. We need to know about it if people don't know this cuisine to begin with. And I think that starting with Burritos on the Border was a really great choice. I can be compelled to the argument that Don't Mind If I Dosa is like a season finale. That feels like a season finale. But Burritos at the Border very much feels like a premiere because the show is Taste the Nation. And it's about the immigrant experience in America. And the immigrant experience in America is certainly not pleasant right now. If it's ever really been,
it hasn't been
pleasant, that's, you know, exactly, you know.
And it's funny. I know you guys didn't watch the hot dog episode, but it was a lot about Germanic culture and how, you know, when the war was coming and any acts of Germanness were persecuted. Yeah, I think that works.
Yeah.
And it was easy. It was not easy for them, but German culture became so intertwined with American culture because of the color of their skin. It was easier for them to assimilate to who was in the area at that point. And I think that makes a huge difference. And I think that's a topic that we're still talking about to this day with people of all color. And it's crazy how relevant this feels right now. Yeah. And maybe it always would feel relevant, but especially right now when the tides are shifting at a much quicker pace, we're hoping, and things are changing, that this really kind of highlights the struggles that a lot of people have gone through.
I think more eyes are on the target right now than there has been in a long time is the thing. And I say it like that rather than eyes are open, because I think that many of the eyes are on the target but are not open to what's going on. And even many of the eyes that are open are opening and are coming from a good place, but are not there yet. Are not like fully grappling with the complexity of the issues that are at play. I would volunteer myself included as, you know, a white man of extraordinary privilege and growing up that way, and facing some anti-Semitism growing up. But otherwise, you know, I present as just a straight white dude who has power in America and power in the world. I think one of the things that is so fascinating about this show and the way that it's talking and interacting with American culture is it is asking what is American culture. It's not just asking like, what is American cuisine, and the answer being that it is this international representation of all of these different cuisines, but how did they get here? And in some cases, many cases, the stories behind the things that you love on your plate so much are ugly and covered in blood and violence and just heinous historic acts of abuse. And I think what is American culture? There's a few different ways to look at that. And I think one of the ways to look at that is like sort of what they sell you in the movies of rah, rah, patriotism, 4th of July, fireworks, hot dogs with ketchup on it or not, and just like, that's America. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we are reckoning with right now also is the reality that like the culture of America is racism. The culture of America is racism. The culture of America is a country that is founded on
colonization.
Yep. And the genocide of a people, the enslavement of other people. I think what this show is positing, and gosh, Emily, what is the name of the author who you're reading right now? Michael Twitty. I think he's the one who has this comment about like the work begins somewhere between the hurt and the healing. And I think that this show is working in that space and offering this opportunity, this possibility in the middle of like so much pain that so many people have just been feeling blanketly forever, that many other people are waking up to the idea that like people have been in pain and now they are in pain, feeling that pain, and they have to work through that pain and help heal that pain. And I think that one of the ways that this show is demonstrating like what is the culture of America is demonstrating, well, there is this other culture of America that is that it's multicultural, that there are so many cultures in America, that there are so many things worth celebrating, that there are so many different people from so many different walks of life who are embracing who they are, who love who they are. Who should not be shot or hunted or persecuted or prejudiced against because of who they are, and that the America that can be, like the aspirational America, can be the America that takes all of the cultures that we see in this episode and wraps them up in a big Padma hug, you know, like
so or burrito
is yeah. So that really hit really hard with me watching the episodes that I've watched. And I think like, cause that's interacting a lot with certainly a lot of the things that I am thinking about and things that I am reckoning with personally, and like ways in which I have personally failed, like ways in which like I have not represented better in like my capacity as a leader in the podcast space. You look at the track list of people that I've podcasted with, and it's predominantly white dudes. And like ways in which like I am.
So all of you are fired. Bye.
You're all fired. I'm never going to talk to you again. But like, if America right now isn't like making you think about that kind of stuff, you know, whatever like your place and your role in that is. But certainly I think I could speak for me as a white guy. That I think like this has hit me hard in a way that I am very hopeful that a lot of the messages that are at play here in Taste the Nation are things that we can get to, are things mm-hmm. that we're moving toward, and things where we're just like hopefully predominantly culturally just going to the loud majority of us will be able to say like fucking enough. You know, this is not going to be the way anymore.
It's interesting in that this show almost presents a paradox. And it's talked about, actually, it's mentioned explicitly in the Germanic second episode of, you know, what does assimilation mean? And does it mean you're overriding your roots? But the weird backside of this is that in embracing American culture, you're essentially embracing a mixture of cultures that are essentially un-American. Hmm. And so where does that tricky balance lie? And I think that probably the most unique episode, which again, I sort of question the placement of it, but it is episode 7 and it's titled The Original Americans.
Yeah.
And it's not a focus on restaurants. It's not a focus on the industry. Yep. It's about the history of Native Americans, Native American cuisine, and the astounding fact that due to, you know, Native Americans were used to obviously living off the land and eating very natural ingredients. And due to the over processed nature of food nowadays, Native Americans are suffering a disproportionate amount of obese and diabetes and obesity related deaths because just of their genetic structure. And it's such a unique episode. They do such a cool thing. They do a non-colonial Thanksgiving, which is freaking awesome.
All about that.
Yeah, they do like a corn and squash mixture instead of stuffing. They do antelope instead of turkey. Like it's all about using non-colonial elements. And hell, I would love to make a push for my next Thanksgiving to look non-colonial because it looked freaking awesome. But to Kurt's point, that felt like a distinctly different episode than everything around it because Native American cuisine has all but disappeared.
And it sounds like it's also like a lot of the episodes are like the impact of a culture on its food. It was almost the impact of a food on a culture.
Yeah, exactly. And how, you know, Padma, they have to go out into the middle of a desert to be like, okay, let's find all these naturally sourced ingredients to make something. And that was a very stark statement to me, was that as much as we're embracing / bastardizing certain elements of cuisines and internationalities, there are people's stories and narratives that are being erased by the day. And it sucks that this is a cuisine that is so inherent literally to the land that we live on, that has just been washed away by so many things to the point where we have to go out to an arid patch of land to be able to find or at least cook in the Native American way using these natural ingredients.
So on that note, there's a really wonderful cookbook that also won a James Beard Award 2 years ago now. It's called The Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X. Oh. And it's great by, or Native American tribe.
It's a good play on Sioux Chef. And it's
totally. So it's all about the indigenous ingredients that Native Americans have historically had access to and used in their own cuisine. And it doesn't borrow on anything that is a colonized product that came over. So there's no wheat. There's no we're cutting out a lot of cows and things like that. There's only buffalo and duck, that kind of thing. And it's by Sean Sherman, and it's an excellent book. I highly recommend you guys check it out. It has such wonderful recipes. You know, Padma touches upon this very quickly, the three sisters, but that is the concept of Native American farming, which is corn, beans, and squash, and how they're a regenerative process of planting all of those things together and making sure that your soil is healthy and safe. Because one of them deposits a bunch of nitrogen into the ground. The other one sort of extracts that. So it's all about this sort of interwoven understanding of farming and land and ecology that we've shown up and just tilled and ruined. And I'd love to see all of us start sort of get back to the roots of understanding soil science. That's another podcast that sounds
good. Ooh, that'd be a fun podcast.
I think people would sign up for the soil science podcast.
I think especially today. Now that we are sort of still in an age, hopefully people are staying in lockdown like they should be, of planting or growing their own stuff if they have the accessible capabilities. I think that is definitely a good subject.
Yeah, historically we've tilled lands and absorbed all the nutrients that were ever there and then done monoculture on all sorts of farmland. So we're not sort of looking towards the plants that are companion plantings, right? Sort of that keep the soil healthy, but also, keep bugs away naturally or, any sort of other natural pesticides. What's that? Other plants, other animals. But either way, I found this episode. Josh, I think this is maybe one more that you should watch.
I'm going to watch them all.
Yeah, you're going to watch them all. But Native American cooking, maybe that should have been the second one, right? So we go from what's sort of very timely to Native Americans as the original people who lived here, who should be celebrated, should be understood better. I mean, I'm excited about the fact that, this week there was a bunch of activity going on.
Yeah. Oh, I love that too, that they mentioned the Standing Rock, right? And then to find out this week that essentially they were given the cease and desist to drill there. It's fantastically timely to have them sort of, talk about how much of an, to have this beautiful image of them making these very native, for lack of a better term, meals to the activists that sat there for months protesting the Dakota Pipeline. And then to hear finally this news come about, a few years after that fact, it was fantastically timely to hear that, sometimes the things that can happen that are outright terrible can go away or at least be warmed over by the actions of people who are inherently good and working towards a good today.
I mean, I love every nugget of good news we can get these days. Mm-hmm. I'm very hungry for that. But they also ruled that half of Oklahoma is Native American land. And so this could backtrack a lot of prosecution that has happened towards Native people and maybe really be in a process. Half of Tulsa is Native American based on the fact that based on this ruling. It's good to see justice work for us when it can. And I just think, we're told a certain set of stories when we're growing up, right? We're told this was the first Thanksgiving. This is how things happen. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what we're all reckoning with or have reckoned with for a while being kids growing up in America is that those stories are so one-sided and controlled and the narrative is so much more complex than that. And what better way to explore all of that than what's on your plate? And Padma, I think in this instance, hats off to her. I really do think that this is a part of a growing dialogue of things that we all need to be able to talk about and be better versed in. And this is an excellent tool in sort of starting to open our minds and our mouths and eat delicious things, but be able to understand what we're looking at, you know, from a larger perspective. So I'm really happy about it.
It's a great show.
So, I mean, hopefully if and when there is a season two, do we feel like there are any cultures or cuisines that she has not touched on, or that she should touch upon again, that was not mentioned in the first season? Because the first season we had Mexican, we had Germanic, we had Indian, we had Gullah, which was sort of like a West African type of thing. We have Chinese, we have Persian, we have Native American, Peruvian, Thai, and Japanese. Is there anything that sticks off the top of your tongues as
Vietnamese.
To... Vietnamese would be a good one.
That's a really important one. I have two, probably Cuban people in South Florida. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be really interesting to see an episode on the very large Muslim population in Michigan.
Yep.
And the impact it has on the food there and the culture there. What else? I would love to see
Jewish deli.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually do think that, I mean, listen, it's not like we need another, you know, story about white people culture, but I do think that the Jewish, especially the Jewish, you know, journeys into America in a number of ways is a very interesting story.
That. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting story to tell, and how that sort of, you know, that cuisine has been assimilated to, and how it also sort of has this duality, and how it also maybe stands in counter to some of the rising neo-Nazi activity today. I think that could be a really cool explanation.
Yeah, show me how you're enjoying your deli, anti-Semites, because
being 25% Polish, I'd like equal time, as we've got a German episode. We will defer our time to the Jewish episode, but if there's any leftover time for a Polish episode, I'd love let's throw that in there.
I mean, should we check out some Russians just so we're all aware? Like, yeah. We can just be a little bit better versed as things continue.
Yeah, we need to understand our growing culture. So,
I read a book last year. It's actually by Edward Lee, who is on Top Chef Texas, called Buttermilk Graffiti. And it does kind of feel like this show. He goes to pockets of America where there's a very large immigrant population. There was a really interesting part. I think it must have been the Nigerian part, where we're just learning about this pocket of African cuisine that isn't as tied to slavery, if that makes sense. Where it's Nigerians who are choosing to come over and make America their home, and it wasn't just by complete force. I think seeing more African cuisine would be really interesting in this too, because it's such a diverse continent, and a lot of North Americans kind of look at it as like one monoculture, when that's just completely not the case at all.
Totally.
I know you mentioned Cuba before, Haley, but I think Caribbean would also be an interesting thing. I would love like a Jamaican episode, for instance, since I know we probably all have experienced Jamaican food in some way, but I think there's a lot connecting back to those ideas, even coming from African roots, and how it sort of had been made into its own form of cuisine, and how that's also then further transformed by its Americanization as well.
I mean, even talking with Top Chef, you know, and Gregory in Haiti, right? Like, that's, no one ever talks about Haitian food beyond like one or two dishes.
Japanese food, like completely.
That's the last episode.
Oh,
come on, Kurt.
You know, it's not something I don't think that they could do because of like the aforementioned corporate structures of who owns which show. But it would be wild to watch an episode that like reckons with Top Chef and the times in which Top Chef got this wrong. Or at least the ways in which American media gets this wrong.
Yeah.
The ways in which American media, pushes narratives that, or just American culture pushes these narratives. But I think media specifically and television specifically has pushed us in directions that are not good.
Well, that's the thing, is that it was really interesting watching the Chop Suey episode, because look, we are all guilty of watching those reality shows where it's like, you have to eat balut. You have to eat a 100-year-old egg. And like,
luckily, Vox is not guilty of this.
And but when you look in back, being like, these are actual delicacies for people in this culture. And I cannot imagine how just terrible it must feel to have you know, ignorant Americans like puking over eating something that you would eat with your grandmother. Yeah. You know, and I know Simone Nguyen actually from Survivor tweeted about this recently, and it definitely has changed sort of my recoloring about viewing a challenge that for the most part has sort of been intrinsic into reality TV. And I think that's one great example of what you're talking about, Josh, of how even outside of Top Chef, like coming to grips with certain reality TV tropes about tokenization and otherization, especially from an international perspective.
Ew, durian, but like that is a big piece of a whole culture's cuisine.
Exactly. Yeah.
There was this happened on social media a couple of weeks ago. And I'm blanking on the woman's name who sort of brought it to light, but I'll put it in the notes. But she basically called out a New York Times writer who is, I believe, Japanese American, and said to her, you know, you write about all of these food, these fruits in Southeast Asia, and the tone of the entire piece is about how they're very difficult to eat. They're very strange looking. It's not worth the effort of like ripping apart certain melons or like, you know, digging through seeds or whatever. It's not, you know, it's a foreign look at something that in reality is a delicacy, is celebrated in these other cultures, should be written in a way that isn't biased towards sort of like the white reader or the right. Western reader who might say, oh, like, never mind, dragon fruit sounds like a nightmare. And it's, you know, but it's ways in which, you know, we sort of other people when we're writing in food media, and how even somebody who's half Asian can get it wrong sometimes, right? Mm. And how we all need to be mindful and respectful and thoughtful about this. But also it's examining the prejudices that we've grown up around, which is like super hard to kind of dig into unless you're really super cognizant of it. You know, that's how MSG has gotten a bad rap. MSG has been proven time and time again to actually not be a problem for people, but consistently they've, you know, been, people have demonized Chinese American restaurants for using MSG.
Right.
And in reality, like, it's like anything else that we have. It's just a seasoning. Like, it's not supposed to be this like horrific thing that causes awful headaches and, you know, makes people sick. And that, you know, in and of itself, once you start to peel back the layers of like, okay, why do people think that Chinese Americans cook with rats and mice and all of this stuff? That's a prejudice. That is like a crazy myth that was put out because there was anti-Chinese sentiment that caused like all of the Chinese Exclusion Act. And because it all boils down to they took our jobs, right? Like, that's what all of this is usually about, even though nobody wanted to build railroads. Like, this was a specifically Chinese immigrant job. And we have them to thank for the fact that like the Industrial Revolution was successful, that people moved out west because they built railroads. And the only thing they were allowed to do was open restaurants or laundries. And like, that's kind of the basis for all of this. I don't know. It's very interesting to sort of dissect a lot of that history and to understand it better. And I welcome everybody to do it, because learning about where your food comes from and the certain tastes that we love is so steeped in all of this culture and all of this history and all of that. There's so much history, like we said before, that is super unsavory and it's really nasty. It's very hard to reckon with. But if you don't, then where are we left? Like, what are we left with? We need to be able to understand it and to support it and to think about it critically. I think, you know, what they bring up, sorry, I'm ranting at this point, but
rant.
Yeah. No, but what they bring up in the Chop Suey episode is like, why is Chinese food so cheap? You know?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be. Look how much work goes into it.
Yeah, and considering like the main, you know, the question that recurred throughout that Chop Suey episode is like, where the hell did Chop Suey come from? Considering that it was sort of marketed as like, well, we'll sort of take some odds and ends and throw it in a stir fry, because that's what, you know, if Americans think that's what Chinese food is, then that's what it is. When really it is like such a more delicate and entrenched in cultural process than we'll take all the leftover stuff and throw it in with some rice and then charge $3.99 for it.
So my grandmother used to make what you would call an American chop suey.
Interesting.
Which was like macaroni noodles and then like tomato and like whatever odds and ends in terms of vegetables and then ground beef thrown in.
Interesting.
And that is a uniquely New England thing, from what I understand, because one of my good friends whose family's from Massachusetts, the same thing. She's like, oh yeah, my grandma made it too. Not very good. But not my favorite, but she used to make it for me, and I'd always be like, American chop suey, okay. And I think it's like, I don't know, because you use olive oil, like, is that what this is? Like, rather,
because the perception is this bunch of stuff thrown together.
Yeah.
Because like in Michigan, we used to make garbage can chili, where it's basically everybody brings a different kind of chili, but you throw everybody's chili into the same pot and then you cook it up. And like that's still the kind of the same. It's almost, I'm seeing a parallel to like, it's just a bunch of stuff thrown together. And I'm surprised that there's probably some family in the Midwest that's referring to that as, you know, chili chop suey or something that's like equally non-reflective or, you know, compassionate. But I thought it was interesting is also these episodes, there's a mix of like for each of them, there's a mix of an assimilation story and a co-opting story, like whether it's kind of we feel we need to change to adapt and assimilate versus American culture pulling it in from this less of a push and more of a pull from the American side, quote unquote, and we're going to adopt and change this ourselves. And I thought there was like a different blend of that across the different stories we saw. Except maybe the Indian one we watched was a little bit different because I think we also watched them in the order of like most accessible to quote unquote least accessible, like Mexican, like most like perceived exoticism of the cuisine. We went from Mexican, which I think everybody thinks they're familiar with, but they're probably not as familiar with as they are, to Chinese, which people I think in America, like, and I'm thinking Midwest.
I mean, Padma literally says in the opening of that episode, basically every town in America has a Chinese food restaurant.
Exactly. But I think it's something that people still go to and think of, this is slightly exotic. I might not always know what I'm get, whereas like Mexican foods, I think the perception is it's much more accessible. And then you have Indian food, which I feel hasn't had that strong foothold, because I think this most recent episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour on NPR talks about Taste the Nation as well. I think it was there that they were talking about how like suddenly, unless it was one of the episodes we watched last night, suddenly like all of a sudden, when did this point happen where every town now has like a Thai restaurant as well? Like there was a point like in the 90s where it went from like no Thai restaurants to every town having a Thai restaurant. And so I think there's this interesting story of for each episode, we have this unique blend of how much is the culture feeling a pressure to adapt versus how much is it the American culture pulling it in and having to like change it to their own. But I also don't see why they could, if there was a second season, there's so much more to mine in these 10 cultures that we have here. Like we could easily have like, the burritos part two, Cantonese cuisine part two.
I think it's like, it's pretty boundless in terms of, the ways in which it could go.
Well, you have pockets of communities all over this continent, right? Like I always remember I grew up right outside of, 45 minutes northwest of Boston. So I was pretty close to the city of Lowell, which historically is sort of, hit hard times here and there, but is a very proud and diverse city. And they have a huge population of Cambodian immigrants there.
Interesting.
I went there and I used to get Cambodian food that was delicious, and I never have been able to find it anywhere else. And obviously I'm not looking super hard. I'm sure I could find it if we live in New York. There's got to be a few pockets of it somewhere, but who knows? And like, why aren't we exploring that more? And I think one of the things we've seen throughout most of these episodes is that people are immigrating for reasons, and that's something I'd like to touch on more. Like, why are they coming over?
Yeah, I think that's what the Persian comedian, who unfortunately his name escapes me, but that sort of is what he said in the Persian episode, right? He's like, people wouldn't go from like be in their country and say, well, you know what? I'm doing super well. I have a great job. I'm making loads of money. But you know what? I'm going to leave that all behind and go to a completely different country. You know, there's a reason why people want to come here. And so that's why this should be, embraced. This is why, the cultures should be embraced and they should be tied into the American experience. I will also say that I think also due to the nature of this show, and I'll also, I think that at least this has a better chance of filming a second season than a lot of other travel shows, because it is not international. And considering, understandably, the edicts against international travels from people going leaving America, to have a food travel show located specifically within American borders, even if there are certain, you know, safety concerns that they'll have to abide by, I'm hopeful this gives the show even better chances of going on to a second season, considering it's just, you know, get in a car, go to this state instead of having to fly anywhere in particular.
All right. Does that taste the nation? What a great show. I'm so glad that we chewed on this a bit conversationally, but like, I'm,
Josh, you love talking about chewing on things in every single podcast we do.
It just comes up.
I thought Josh is teething. It's fine.
I'm still teething. They're still coming in. They're still coming in.
I will tell you, as someone who has a son who is teething, it can get very nasty and blood drawing at a certain point. So I fear for Emily in that circumstance.
Yikes.
There will be points in time where I will, like, I was just podcasting the other day and I got out and my son runs towards me and I like pick him up and he just like sinks his teeth into my shoulder and just starts laughing maniacally, and I pull him off and then he comes back in again. He thinks essentially it's a game of like, let me bite my parents and laugh about it. So that's been what we've been going through recently with our parenting. So
that's why you have two hunks of flesh missing from your shoulders.
I wasn't going to mention it, but yeah, I'm going to have him on, and when he's able to talk to ask what the taste of human flesh indeed is.
Yeah, raisin starting
taste
to
taste the parents. Yeah.
Taste the parents.
Oh no.
All right, what are we eating?
Yeah.
What are we making? What are we eating? We ate a lot of Korean food this week.
We ate a lot of Szechuan
Korean
food.
Restaurant.
I made poke.
You made Emily made nice. Poke. And it was unreal. It
what was your protein good. In the poke?
Tuna.
Ooh, that's interesting.
I don't normally buy because it's very overfished. And also, I don't know, it's not like my number one when I go to the fishmonger that we go to, but I had to wait outside for a while. It was really hot out because there's only two people in at a time. And by the time I came in there, I was like, okay, I'll take some salmon, but also like this big, beautiful, like, piece of tuna was just staring at me. So like while they were like wrapping the salmon up, I was like, this is sushi grade, and they were like, yeah, like, okay, cool.
That's amazing.
That. It was so great. You made it with ponzu,
little sesame oil, some shaved garlic and ginger,
scallions, avocado.
Yeah, I had avocado over rice that had a little bit of rice wine vinegar in it. So
rice had a little bit of rice in it.
It had some.
I love my
rice
to be with rice. Yeah. So good.
It was awesome. It was
a really hot day too, so it was nice to not have something that was warm. You know what I mean?
It was awesome because like we hadn't had anything like that since quarantine began. You know, like I don't think that we've had any flavor that was really similar to that. Like we've made great smart Japanese meals. You've been making like lots of like rice dishes with tofu and sweet potato and a lot of those flavors, but like the fresh tuna was just so welcome.
Piece of tuna.
So welcome. It felt like, you know, like a sushi bowl, and it was just unbelievably great. That was the standout of the week for sure.
Nice. I had a tuna sandwich from Jersey Mike's, so
nice.
I can relate.
Jersey Mike's is not bad.
Yeah, Haley, what'd you up to food wise?
What did I do? God, like, because I've been working a lot of like evenings, I haven't been cooking a whole lot. But some food things, not necessarily food, but I did make a really great mojito this week. I have
that
mint in my garden that I thought, gosh, I should use that. And then one of my friends, her family owns an orchard, and cherries are ready here in Southern Ontario. So we went cherry picking. So I've just been eating a lot of cherries. And then yesterday for lunch, I made Ethan and I a very nice charcuterie board because I had bought some bougie cheeses earlier in the week. I bought a smoked cheddar at the local farmer's market yesterday morning. And then when I was at the butcher earlier, I found a maple cheddar, I think. Oh, it's so delicious. So I had to buy that. So it was simple things. You know, it's been so hot. We didn't want to cook a whole lot this week.
Charcuterie and cherries.
That sounds awesome.
As long as you don't drink iced milk with cherries, because that's how President Taylor died.
Yeah.
Well, an overindulgence of iced milk and cherries. Overindulgence
of cherries and milk on a hot summer day.
I try not to eat,
mind you,
too many cherries at one time because I have heard of some effects.
I'm like watching Mike, like the wheels in motion where he's like, I need to Google this.
Mike is on Snopes.
I don't know.
He skips Snopes.
Well, I don't know. My fascination with the musical Assassins made me realize how many, you know, a good amount of the presidents died. But Zachary Taylor, obviously, died of something. Died of a stomach virus after eating a bowl. Oh my God.
All right, future podcast is the iced milk and cherry challenge.
Don't be like Zachary Taylor.
What if I did a true crime podcast where I just like broke that down?
Yeah.
I was like, someone murdered him with those cherries.
I'm here for that episode here on Beyond Pop Chef.
So we could have a true crime podcast. We could have a true crime. We could have a true crime episode called Serial, where we talk about that and cereal.
Wow. Zachary Taylor.
Maple syrup heist. Too.
Zachary Taylor,
or the Great Molasses Disaster of Boston.
Yeah, I was just
Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was just gonna say Zachary Taylor and William Henry Harrison just like skyrocketed to the list of like the dumbest presidents ever for easily preventable deaths. Stop putting cherries in your body, Zachary Taylor.
Like, he did eventually.
So I remember reading this in my like AP history class senior year, and I was like, shut the hell up, this is not real. And I've never forgotten it. Like,
yeah, should they do a Hamilton-esque musical about Zachary Taylor? The cherries played by Leslie Odom Jr., and that's what eventually kills him.
I'm not putting away my milk. No, I'm not putting away my milk.
Yeah, don't even write new music. Just write different lyrics.
Eat your cherries and milk. Oh, yeah. Eat your cherries.
Anyway.
Oh, my God.
Mike, what did you do for food?
So I'll go with something that I mimed out last week that unfortunately I was not able to speak about. But for the first time last week at my in-laws, I had fried pumpkin blossoms.
Cool. Which
I had never had before. I mean, essentially, it's like a vegetarian zeppoli, where it's essentially like, no, it didn't. But it's just really simple. Like they're growing. My in-laws are growing pumpkins out in the vineyard, and so they just took some flowers off of that, put them in some batter, fried them up, and they were. I mean, listen, the taste was mostly batter, but it had like a nice hint of sweetness to it. I know it's also usually done with zucchini, but it's like a big Italian thing. So I'd recommend to people, like, if you have access to it and you are jonesing for the county fair days that will be missed out on due to the nature of this summer, like, go for the pumpkin flowers, man. Never had a pumpkin flower in my life before that, and I was very happily surprised by it.
Yeah, Fox makes a mean squash blossom.
Blossom.
So love their music. Unless you use an electronic thermometer and have it on Celsius instead of Fahrenheit, in which you almost burn your kitchen down when you are heating the oil.
Oh yeah, that was in the middle of a wiggle room the other week.
That definitely happened like a week and a half ago.
That was fun. Yeah. But they came out very charred, and I burnt food, so I was like, I'll eat that.
I figured it out very fast.
It was very good. It was really good.
Yeah, you walked in the room immediately after podcasting and crushed the most burned, awful piece. Like there were three other pieces.
I was very happy to do it. Yeah. I would do it again.
Yeah.
No, my mom would. She would burn cookies. She would give them to the dog. They weren't chocolate chip cookies, but the dog then learned to flip them over with their nose. And if it was burned to the bottom, she wouldn't eat them.
Wow. Dogs have discerning taste,
snob.
Man.
Cookie snob.
Can't all be Zachary Taylor.
Yeah. Wolfing down every cherry you see.
Wolfing ready my ass.
Are we spelling Taylor T-A-I-L?
T-A-Y. Oh, if you want to name your dog after one of the stupidest people, then sure. Well,
Zachary Taylor Twitter is going to come for us, I think.
Yeah.
All five of them.
Yeah,
leave my great, 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 great grandfather alone.
Yeah.
So this week I was exploring variations on the Clark family recipe of beans and ground beef. I did beans and ground lamb.
Cool.
And I added diced up green olives and feta cheese and kind of a garlic sauce. That was pretty good.
Kurt, what is your stance on lamb, especially after trying it in a ground up way in response to this week's Wiggle Room?
Yeah, lamb shanks and apple cider. You in or you out?
I have not listened to this week's Wiggle Room yet, but I'm fine with that. Sounds tasty.
Yeah, agreed.
I went to Whole Foods to pick up a package at their Amazon lockers, and I walked away with a bunch of food. And so this is for the, I have a lot of visuals from my co-hosts, which is going to be great for the audio podcast, but I picked up, Natural Delights, cocoa and, pecan medjool date rolls.
Ooh.
Yeah.
These might have predated my Whole Foods trip. I did pick up, those vegan and nut free, the sandwich cookies that I was, had before
that I can eat,
that you can eat. And also I picked up another container of that, that chocolate sweet sauce, which is, a egg free,
Kurt just wants me to come visit.
Yeah. I want to visit Kurt. So this works.
Yeah.
GMO free, vegan, gluten free, but it's called, chocolate sweet sauce. Picked up two of my favorite dips from the Majestic Garlic Company, a sun-dried jalapeno, delicious, creamy garlic.
Ooh, and the anthropomorphized garlic is winking at you.
Yeah, and then a basil version of said dip.
That garlic really just wants you to say hi. It's like, hey.
Yeah. That garlic slid into your DMs and was like, you up.
You really should know that the garlic looks very suggestive to the people who do
it's
not
sitting
have
in, black, it's, so. It's sitting in a questionable pool of... We referred to this as spume, I think, previously.
The spume's back.
And then lastly, the chocolate swirl brioche.
Ooh. Yeah.
All right, Fox can't eat that.
Fox cannot eat this. So, but those garlic spreads are amazing. Like, even they're raw vegan, and I will still eat them, and I will eat them all up.
Mm. Okay.
And I also have a food delivery service. HelloFresh, no surprise. I did pick up a couple of just extra proteins, a couple salmon fillets with it. So I need to figure out how to cook those this week. So I may be getting into a group text with y'all otherwise I'll just throw some olive oil in a pan and heat them up, but that seems boring.
Yeah. I mean, you can pan fry them if you want to, or you can do other fun things with them.
Yeah. We'll talk.
Yeah. Sounds good. I like that. Yeah. Hey, we forgot to say, I made gumbo and rice and red beans, too.
What?
Ooh,
yeah. How ricey was your rice?
It was
very ricey. It was like rice on rice.
It was really good.
Do you put Worcestershire in your red beans and rice?
I do not.
I had the most amazing red beans and rice at a gastro pub in Chicago a few years back, and I don't know what was in it. I thought
you were going to say gas station.
At a gas station. No, I get my sushi from gas stations. How did you prepare the red beans and rice?
Okay, so I used the Dookie Chase cookbook, which is a legendary restaurant in New Orleans. It's the site of a lot of civil rights movement related sort of gatherings.
Civil rights movement?
Yeah, you know the civil rights movement?
Yeah.
You heard of that?
Yeah. I think it's rice.
Chris said the civil rice movement.
I'm sorry. I'm like, huh? Why is that funny? Dookie Chase was run by Dookie and his wife, Leah Chase, who she just passed away last year, I want to say now. And she was in her 90s. I actually got to sort of be in the same room with her when I went to New Orleans 3 years ago now for a class that I took in grad school. And she came out and sort of had prepared this meal for us. And at one point even goes, there are no eggs in anything. So you can have, like, there were a couple of us that were like, I'm allergic to mushrooms. I'm allergic to eggs. I'm allergic to nuts. And she came out being like, all of these things are allergen free for all of you. Please enjoy.
And that wasn't like per the original recipes, right? Those are alterations made specifically for you.
I just looked through it and her fried chicken has eggs in it. So she made fried chicken without eggs for me. And I geeked out beyond belief. Like, I could cry thinking about it. Anyway.
That's awesome.
Her red beans and rice recipe is mostly just like very, kind of normal ingredients, but done in a way that's super well prepared. So, and there's a lot of animal fat in it, so that makes it really good. So you make the red beans together with, chopped onion, and then you let that simmer for a really long time because you're working from dried red beans and not something from a can. And then over time, you add the aromatics, you add thyme, like fresh thyme, garlic, a little bit of chili. And then you put in pork belly and ham if you have it. So we had a little bit of pork belly and I was like, cool, that's going to be delicious. And it was super good.
Nice.
And I lived off of that for the next like 2 days.
Yeah, we
would you have put honey baked ham in it if that was an option?
I would have put honey baked ham
in it. Oh, yeah, we got to work on getting that to you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a recurring gag, right? The honey baked ham that never was.
Emily's not laughing.
We'll do it.
We're going to do it.
Yeah.
That should be our one podcast for Beyond Top Chef as we remind ourselves that we need to get the ham and we get the ham on air.
I keep forgetting because there is one near me and I keep wanting to go pick one up and I keep forgetting.
You'll love it. You're going to be so happy.
I've had it before.
Yeah.
But it's just, it hasn't been, I want it now.
Yeah.
But I like,
care how.
All right, Veruca.
Yeah.
I was literally just saying, Daddy, I want it now. Yeah.
Honey baked ham and golden eggs.
I mean, listen, Kurt did have a bean feast last week.
I did have a bean feast.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, well, you know, the book, it wasn't eggs, it was nuts and squirrels.
Oh, she was a, sorry, Miss Wonka. They'd stolen your fizzy lifting drink.
Which is the one way that the Johnny Depp remake was more true to the book is that they had the squirrels and nuts in that version and not the goose and the eggs.
Trash.
Yeah.
Who wants to be true to a book considering that Roald Dahl's is like wants to scare children?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he has a pretty upsetting story. I mean, that's another podcast entirely.
Yes, it's another
really Beyond Top Chef. What we do, as a subject, maybe as a tangent, but do not we, as the subject.
Yeah, do we prefer Everlasting Gobstoppers or Giant Peaches?
I mean, that would work. That
I
works.
Would eat a giant
that
peach
works.
Any day of the week.
I think the Chocolate Factory versus the Giant Peach and the merits of which choice you make in which to live, I think, is a fair.
Or you drink George's Marvelous Medicine and you grow so much you explode.
Or you're one of the witches and you eat children.
Yes. And you turn them into rats? Yeah. What did Angelica Houston turn the boy into?
Yeah, into a mouse or a rat or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
anyway, we're not talking about that next week.
Yeah, but what are we doing next week? Because I know Josh, you proposed something right before we came on air that is super exciting.
Well, we've been talking internally about what is the breadth of content that we can cover here as we're
I love the idea of the breadth of content.
The breadth of content.
Like the bread of content.
The bread of content.
Yeah, that's better.
You know, does it just have, it's going to be, everything has to tie into food. This is a food focused podcast. Does it all have to be food TV? Does it all have to be food TV focused podcast? I think we're going to experiment with the fact that maybe no, maybe not. We'll try. We'll see. And we're going to do a podcast I've been so excited to do for so, so long. And it's finally going to happen. This is such a wonderful group with which for it to happen.
You were so casual in how you pitched it to us. And now that you're revealing.
I know. And well, now that you've all agreed, now
I feel like it's a long con.
Then I'm really, really excited that we're just going to have a pizza party next week. We're going to have a pizza party on the podcast next week. Next week's podcast is a pizza party. We're all going to get pizza at some point during the week. We'll report back on our pizza adventures. I think we'll just share memories of pizza that we've had over the years. And I think we're just going to have a fun time with pizza.
And I think everybody has to save a slice of cold breakfast pizza for Saturday morning when we record.
I would like that as well. And I know that like eating food on a podcast is taboo. What I would propose is that the person who is that we take turns eating the breakfast slice, the person who is eating mutes themselves, and then everyone who is unmuted comments on the eating of the breakfast slice. And then we will get the takes from the person who is eating the breakfast slice after they've unmuted themselves.
Okay, maybe we eliminate the commentary on someone eating.
All right, maybe the comment, but what does the quality of the pizza look like? And then we'll do the reviews after the person unmutes themselves.
We will have to literally use the mute button. I have a strange number of friends who suffer from misophonia and chewing sounds and
that's
gum.
We will eliminate that. Okay. We will not have chewing sounds on the podcast.
Okay.
And if you are a $100,000 patron, you can watch us eat pizza. That's, but otherwise, you'll just have to imagine.
Who created Crunchy Mouth? No, that was Jess that created Crunchy Mouth Sounds as a song. Can we commission her to do Soft Mouth Sound?
Crusty Mouth Sound.
I've watched that movie before.
I don't like this idea.
Anyway, pizza
I'm
party.
Yeah.
Pizza party.
Pizza now, party. Haley, they have pizza in Canada, right?
Yeah, but they've
do they call it like
beaver tails? They use beaver tails instead of dough, instead of the base for pizza. Yeah, so
you can make your pizza, you can order your pizza, just get pizza, and let's have a pizza party next week.
Sounds good. I can't wait.
It'll be fun.
And with
I have Friday off from work. Sorry, because I'm excited because I have Friday off, which means I can like go exploring the city to find like something interesting from a pizza perspective if I haven't by that.
I'm going to try and show up with like 18 different pizzas. I'm going to do it.
What if I just shovel a bunch of pizza flavored goldfish down my gullet over the course of the podcast?
I think that's fair though.
I guess that's fair, like, but I think it's lame.
Like pizza flavored Pringles can that like sounds be like me to a tea, Josh.
Mm-hmm. Fair but lame. Blended pizza into a smoothie.
Oh man, Fox, don't ruin pizza for me.
Haley, you were saying? Sound like a wrap up?
Yeah, I think that's it. Okay, bye.
Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.